on the front lines of the fight against Ebola in West Africa. What health workers still need to contain the deadly virus. Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. Also ahead this Thursday in El Salvador, stopping the surge of migrant children entering the U.S. at the source by improving the dangerous conditions that force them to flee.
They explain, you know, to stay is to die. To go is possibly to die, but to possibly have a better future as well.
President Obama's former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, writes a candid memoir about his former boss and current foreign policy challenges.
It isn't just ISIS. We're dealing with North Korea. We're dealing with Iran. We're dealing with Russia. We're dealing with cyber attacks. It is an unprecedented set of threats that are out there. This is not a time to kind of get in the trenches and not say anything.
Plus, combating climate change by transforming ponds once caked with salt into vibrant marshes teeming with wildlife.
This pond in particular has been called a Disneyland for birds. We're really trying to maximize the amount of habitat that's available to them in a novel way.
Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by BNSF Railway and by BAE Systems. Inspired work. Supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And
this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
100 U.S. Marines and more military aid arrived in Liberia today to battle Ebola. At the same time, leaders from Liberia and neighboring countries pleaded for the outside world to make good on pledges to help. Appeals from West African leaders dominated a World Bank meeting in Washington today. On video link, the presidents of Sierra Leone and Liberia pressed for action, not just talk.
Without your quick response, a tragedy unforeseen in modern times will threaten the well-being and compromise the security of people everywhere.
This means the construction of treatment and testing and burying centers within a time frame of 1 month. By mid-November, all such facilities functioning with staff health workers, both local and expatriate.
The president of Guinea appeared in person, adding his own request for money and facilities. Together, their three countries account for virtually all of the nearly 4,000 Ebola deaths so far. The disease claimed its first victim in the U.S. yesterday. Thomas Eric Duncan contracted the disease in Liberia before flying to Texas. And in Spain, officials announced the condition of Teresa Romero has declined. She's a nurse who treated an Ebola patient and was diagnosed herself this week.
The patient has expressly forbidden us to give information about her health and clinical condition. I've only come here to confirm that her clinical condition has worsened.
Four more people who had contact with Romero were placed in isolation units for monitoring. They included a doctor who said he cared for the nurse without being told she was infected. The case has prompted protests by health workers and others in Madrid and questions about how the nurse was infected in the first place.
We have followed all the necessary precautions they've told us to follow. Are those rules incorrect? That we don't know.
The European Commission joined today in demanding that Spain give full explanations of exactly what happened. Meanwhile, a United Nations employee infected in Liberia arrived for treatment in Leipzig, Germany today, and international airports in New York, Newark, Washington, Chicago, and Dallas prepared new screening for travelers from West Africa, including fever checks and other measures. Those measures don't apply at New York's LaGuardia Airport, and 200 airplane cabin cleaners staged a 24-hour strike there today, citing health and safety concerns. And in Washington, a mostly Republican group of 26 lawmakers sent President Obama a letter calling for even more stringent restrictions, including visa bans and quarantines. At the same time, U.S. troops at Fort Hood, Texas, stepped up safety training ahead of being deployed to West Africa. We'll hear from one of the medical groups struggling to corral the outbreak after the news summary.
American and coalition planes stepped up their aerial assault in Syria today, but Islamic State forces made gains anyway. Syrian activists said the militants now control more than a third of Kobani, a key town on the border with Turkey. As the airstrikes continued, Turkish military tanks again looked on without intervening. But the Turkish foreign minister called for a comprehensive plan before his country launches an attack.
It's not realistic to expect Turkey to carry out a ground operation on its own. Our negotiations are continuing about all our suggestions. Negotiations with our allies are continuing. Turkey will not hesitate to do its part when a common decision is reached.
Later, Secretary of State John Kerry called the militants' advance on Kobani a tragedy, but he said it will not alter the Obama administration's long-term strategy.
The rapidly deteriorating situation in Yemen took a turn for the worse today. Nearly 70 people were killed in a pair of suicide bombings. The attacks bore the hallmarks of Sunni militants linked to al-Qaeda. One of the bombers targeted a large group of Shiite rebels who now control the capital city, Sana'a. Bloodstains and debris littered the streets in the aftermath.
A total of 19 people are now dead in the worst fighting between India and Pakistan in more than a decade. Heavy shelling erupted more than a week ago in Kashmir, a mostly Muslim region claimed by both sides. The two sides traded warnings today to stand down, but the fighting continued.
There's word from Mexico that authorities have captured the reputed leader of the Juarez drug cartel. Mexican officials say Vicente Carrillo Fuentes was taken in the northern city of Torreon. The U.S. had offered $5 million for his arrest.
Black leaders in St. Louis call today for the Justice Department to investigate the latest fatal shooting of a black teenager. Police said an off-duty officer killed 18-year-old Vonderit Myers last night after the teen fired first. The shooting sparked protests 11 miles from Ferguson, where another officer killed Michael Brown in August. St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson called for calm.
I'm being as open and transparent as the department can be, and I hope the public appreciates that. I know emotions are high, and I know tensions are high, but the reality is what we've seen, or what the evidence tells me right now, is an individual pointed a gun at a police officer, fired at least three rounds, and continued to pull the trigger.
The teenager's relatives disputed the police account and insisted he was not armed. Police did not identify the officer or give his race.
French author Patrick Modiano has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was honored today for decades of work that focused on the Nazi occupation of France during World War II. The 69-year-old writer has published more than 40 books, but he's relatively unknown in the English-speaking world.
This was another wild day on Wall Street. Jitters over global growth sent energy stocks plunging and triggered a broad sell-off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had its biggest loss of the year, nearly 335 points, one day after its biggest gain of the year. It finished at 16,659. The NASDAQ dropped 90 points to close at 4378, and the S&P 500 fell 40 to finish at 1928. Still to come on the News Hour, containing Ebola at its epicenter in West Africa. U.S. efforts to stop the surge of migrant children illegally crossing the border. Leon Panetta doesn't hold back in his new memoir. Creating vibrant marshes to combat climate change. Why Arkansas Republicans are supporting an initiative to raise the minimum wage. Plus, a new book explores the importance of living and dying well.
Despite new pledges of aid, international leaders provided downbeat assessments of the current battle against Ebola. The head of the World Bank said the international community had, quote, failed miserably in its initial response. The director of the CDC said the situation reminded him of the early days of the AIDS epidemic. We get our own assessment from one of the few non-governmental groups treating patients in West Africa. International Medical Corps has built a treatment unit in Liberia and is constructing other facilities in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. Its president and CEO, Nancy Wassey, joins me now. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Connie.
How many beds, how many facilities, how many people would you say that you're engaged in treating?
Okay, so in Liberia, International Medical Corps opened up a 70-bed hospital, or actually we called it a treatment unit. We opened that up in mid-September. We are scaling up and we'll be opening up another treatment unit in Sierra Leone. In Liberia, we have about 200 people working in this treatment unit, trying to contain it, as well as treating people who have Ebola with the hopes that they will recover, and they are recovering when they receive treatment.
Do you have any sense that the progress of this disease is slowing?
Well, let me say that it's clear that efforts like ours and other organizations are working. When there are treatment efforts, when there are healthcare workers to treat patients as they come in. I mean, our first patients that arrived to our treatment unit, they died at the doorstep. Mm. But now we see that patients are recovering and they're returning back to their families. So any efforts around treatment and containment are working. The problem and the challenge is that there are just not enough operational efforts on the ground. That's the challenge.
Is that because a lack of international action or non-governmental action, or is it because the infrastructure in these communities is so difficult that even if you sent them 10 collapsible hospitals, pop-up hospitals, they couldn't build them?
Okay. Well, it's a number of factors. One, certainly the healthcare infrastructures are very weak in West Africa, under-resourced. They don't have enough health workers. That's one thing. The second thing is the spread was not contained more quickly some months ago. International donors are stepping up. In fact, our treatment unit in Liberia was made possible from a grant from USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. It took $5 million to open that up and about $1 million a month. So part of it is the resources need to be there, but also people are really afraid. They're afraid to provide treatment because they also need to keep their own health workers safe. And so one of the things that we've done is we have said to other community health people as well as other international NGOs, we will provide case management protocol training. We will train their workers so that they can open up more treatment facilities. The problem we have now is that the disease and the outbreak is outpacing the operational efforts on the ground. There are a lot of plans in place, by the way, to change that, and
right,
we're still within that window.
Well, this part about how you keep health workers safe is something that was raised in a piece we had on the NewsHour last night about CDC workers preparing to go abroad. It takes 20 minutes to get into one of those suits, long to get out of those suits, and it's possibly more difficult. Are you suffering at all from lack of willingness of volunteers to take all that on?
Yeah, great question. So the suits, it's very complicated. We have, you can only stay in them about 2 hours in Africa. It's that hot. We have a buddy system because people make mistakes. Mm. And so we have someone watching the other health workers so that they don't infect themselves through a basic mistake. But what we're finding is that, when people are properly equipped and they have the proper protocols in place, they can successfully treat patients and it can be contained. But that training, that knowledge is very important. And so what we've done is we have said, when organizations come to, say Liberia, we will provide 7 to 10 days of training. And as well, the U.S. military is putting together a 25-bed hospital in Liberia specifically to take care of health workers. Because mm-hmm. one of the challenges around, they call it the nurse killer in Liberia. One of the challenges around Ebola is that health workers are willing to step forward and help, and they're very heroic. But our recruitment efforts are helped greatly by the fact that we can treat them if they catch Ebola.
An organization like yours, the International Medical Corps, Ebola is not your only goal. You also are working in places like the Central African Republic or in Syria among refugees. How do you stop resources from being stretched too thin to handle all of these crises at one time?
Right. Well, we're in unprecedented times. I mean, we have 6 Category 3 emergencies. That is the highest emergency. Never in our history have we had that. I mean, one of the toughest years would have been 2 a year. And we've had 6, and we have 6 now in the last 6 months alone. So, it's all hands on deck. We're hopeful that supporters, you know, both government agencies and private sector, the private sector is starting to step in to the Ebola fight, the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. They're an important part of these efforts. But the fact is, it's like we have to do it on all fronts, frankly. It's impossible to pick them on these because they're all at the highest level they can be.
There are some places where they've been able to stop the spread and some places where they haven't. We heard the head of the World Bank today say that there is nothing less than the future of Africa is at stake right now. Do you see that?
This can be stopped and it can be contained, but it has to be. It absolutely has to be stopped because the fact of the matter is we have two countries, Sierra Leone and Liberia, who are coming back from the brink of civil war. I mean, they have done so much to come back from where they were. And for them to be now dealing with Ebola on top of it, this crisis is a global crisis. It's a world problem. It's not just West Africa. We are all in it together. And we have to take the view that it is everyone's problem. And whatever resources it takes, we have to be there because it's going to continue to spread if we're not there. And it has to be stopped and contained at the source.
Nancy Wasi, President and CEO of the International Medical Corps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gwen. Thanks.
Earlier this year, a record number of unaccompanied children from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador arrived in the United States, sparking a crisis and a political backlash. As part of its response, the White House announced tens of millions of dollars in new spending in those countries aimed at stopping the flow of unaccompanied kids and the crime driving them from home. The NewsHour's P.J. Tobia takes a look at those U.S.-funded programs and the children they're supposed to be helping.
In Central America, this is the front line of the Obama administration's fight to keep children from joining gangs or making the dangerous journey to the United States. It's the opening of a new community center in Usulatan, a violent El Salvadoran city controlled by the Mara 18 gang. 140 of these U.S. government-funded centers are spread between Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. There are plans to double that number. They offer sports, skills training, and computer literacy. It's a response to the flood of children trying to make their way to the U.S. border. One of them was 10-year-old Brando. The NewsHour has agreed to conceal his and his grandmother's faces for their safety. Brando's grandmother was desperate to get him out of the country after a violent drug gang tried to extort the family.
Things here are awful. Here they take kids, they return them in pieces.
She sent Brando north over land with an uncle. It was a grueling journey.
We slept where the cows are.
In a barn. There were days they slept in a barn. When they left here, they went to Guatemala. When they crossed, Mexican immigration caught them.
After that, Brando was brought back to El Salvador. Like most people here, he and his grandmother don't leave the house after 6 p.m. for fear of the gangs.
I can't sleep. When I'm able to sleep, I wake up. I only sleep 1 or 2 hours when I hear the gunshots during the night. It will be some time before I can send the child to school.
Brando says he'd still like to try and make it to the U.S., but his grandmother says they can't afford another attempt. Elizabeth Kennedy has spent the last year in El Salvador on a Fulbright scholarship. She's interviewed more than 300 children like Brando who have tried and failed to make it to the United States.
In June, there was one day that we got 300 kids deported from Mexico in one day.
In Mexico, the detained children are sent to a facility in Tapachula near the Guatemalan border. Then they're sent back home.
So we had one 12-year-old boy who came here, who had been robbed and beaten inside of the Siglo XXI detention center in Tapachula. He didn't have any shoes. He was crying.
Once back in El Salvador, there's little the government can do for them.
And there's no follow-up services at the moment. For those who are afraid for their lives, they're probably going to try again within 2 months.
That's where these U.S. government-funded children's centers come in. This center, just outside of San Salvador, provides a place for children to play and learn computers. For older children, this bakery is a skills training program. But Kennedy says that USAID, the government agency behind the centers, doesn't follow through with long-term funding.
So I've learned of a number of programs that receive large multi-million dollar grants, they were supposed to create something that would be sustainable after the money ended at 2 years, and there's nothing to show for it 2 years later after the money has run out.
Mark Feirstein is a USAID associate administrator focusing on Latin America. He says it's up to the local governments to pay the bills when U.S. money runs out.
Sustainability is vital. And the real key here are the Zuckerberg governments themselves. They need to be raising revenue. They need to be energizing their own private sector. So what the USAID can do, and the United States government can do, is support the efforts of these Central American governments. But ultimately, they need to be raising the revenue.
Kennedy says that the centers are often located in contested gang territory.
The reality is, for kids who live in a contested gang territory, for example, you know, crossing the street could be the cause of their death.
Well, that's the point. They are in dangerous neighborhoods, and we're trying to create safe havens for children, and the fact that they're trying to get to these places speaks to their value.
Another issue is a controversial USAID policy. The agency won't fund programs explicitly aimed at current gang members. Jeff Dale is the program director at the Washington Office on Latin America.
I think that's understandable. I think it's a mistake. People aren't going to leave gangs unless there are alternatives, and somebody's got to work with that population. And then related to that, that people coming out of prison are going to go back if they don't have some alternative. And they're going to go back because they pick up gang life again and they are recidivists and they go back to extorting people and threatening them and the whole range of that kind of thing.
Feirstein says that while there may not be programs aimed directly at current gang members, the youth centers don't do background checks on those who come for services and training.
Any youth is welcome there. You know, people are not being filtered when they arrive there. So if someone comes to a youth center and wants to participate, wants to get workforce training, they're welcome to do so.
USAID officials say that the youth centers are only a piece of their effort. Meanwhile, the Pentagon and State Department also play a role through security initiatives and media campaigns, all aimed at convincing Central American children not to leave home in the first place. But back in El Salvador, the root causes driving these child migrants persist, even getting worse after they return home.
And so they explain, you know, to stay is to die. To go is possibly to die, but to possibly have a better future as well.
It's a risk that all too many are willing to take.
You can learn more about the State Department's efforts to train local police in El Salvador. We have the latest in a reporting series from our partners at Fronteras. That's on our homepage at pbs.org/newshour.
We turn now to a memoir from an Obama administration insider that's gaining headlines for its critical assessments of the president. The author, Leon Panetta, spent decades in Washington, first as a legislative assistant, later a congressman, and then President Reagan's chief of staff, before retiring to his home state of California. He was coaxed back into government by President Obama, who persuaded Panetta to serve as director of the CIA and then Secretary of Defense. In those roles, he was involved in the War on Terror, the assassination of Osama bin Laden, and the wind down of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He writes about all of this in Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. I spoke with him earlier this afternoon. Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Judy.
So the book Worthy Fights comes in the middle of some fierce debates here in Washington about domestic policy, certainly international policy. What contribution do you think the book will have to those debates?
Well, I very much wanted to, first of all, tell my life story, because in many ways it's the American story. And all of the different fights that I engaged in and all of the different positions I've held. And to point out that, in fact, if you stay in it and fight, that you can get things done. And I guess the lessons that I would like people to draw is that at a time when there's so much dysfunction in this town, that it is a time when leadership really does need to confront the challenges we're facing abroad as well as the challenges here at home. And I've said, you know, we govern in a democracy by leadership or crisis. And too often today we govern by crisis We need to get back to governing by leadership.
You said the other day, talking about the war against Islamic State, and you said you think it's something that's going to go on for 30 years. If you were at the table right now, would you be arguing that the U.S. should ramp up the effort or leave it to the people and the countries in the region?
Well, we're going to have to be very flexible because we're dealing with a resilient enemy. That's obvious. ISIS is, they're well-armed, they're well-funded, they're well-trained. You can see them using very careful tactics here on the battlefield, now going after this town on the border. They go into hiding. They're hiding their equipment. So we have got to be very resilient in the way we handle this. I mean, I think the approach of the president is right. We've got, we've deployed troops to Iraq. We're trying to get their security force to be able to be effective in pushing ISIS back. We're going to arm and train the rebels. We've decided to use air attacks, which are extremely helpful. But it has to be continuing with a great deal of pressure and a great deal of attention to objectives. You've got to set objectives so that we can show the American people and the world that we can win in this war on ISIS.
You do talk about the president's leadership in the book. Wasn't the administration dealing with Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq somebody who was going to go his own way? How could some more persuasion by President Obama have made a difference?
My experience was Maliki operated under pressure. You had to constantly pressure him on almost everything he did. He was that kind of prime minister. And so when we wanted him to make decisions on governing, we had to pressure him. When we wanted to make him decisions on security, we had to come down hard on him. So coming down and putting that kind of pressure on him, saying we're not going to provide military aid to you, we're not going to give you F-16 fighters,
right,
I think would have been one way to try to at least see whether or not he could have agreed to it.
You also write at another point in the book that the president, it was a mistake for the U.S. not to go ahead and arm and train Syrian rebels. And yet, for more than 10 years, the U.S. did train and arm the Iraqi army. And we've saw just in the last few months the Iraqi army completely collapse. This was training done part of the time while you were Secretary of Defense. My question is, what makes you believe it would have worked with the Syrian rebels when it didn't work in Iraq?
Well, again, to return to the book and how I described the situation, because frankly, for 4 years serving this president, and as I said in the book, it was an honor to serve this president. He was very strong in supporting the operations that we did at the CIA. He supported the bin Laden operation, and he supported the efforts that we had at Secretary of Defense. He was a strong leader with regards to the war on terrorism. And I think he knows that in confronting terrorism, we are going to have to take these things on. He's learned lessons from the things that I talk about. We have 10,000 troops in Afghanistan. He made the decision to do that. I think that's the right decision. He's decided to arm and train the rebels. The reality is, unless we are there and defining moderate rebel forces in Syria, we won't have any boots on the ground. We won't have any sources on the ground to guide us as we do air attacks. If ISIS is there and command and control is there, we have got to have somebody somehow be able to identify those targets so we can go after them.
But you're very candid in the book, Secretary Panetta, about points at which you think the president should have gone in another direction, should have worked more with Congress. I guess my question is, the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said at one point, he said he was a great devotee of history. He said it was wrong. He said it's harmful for people to write candid memoirs while the presidents they serve are still in office. And yet you, Secretary Clinton, Secretary Gates, have all written candid memoirs. Is it that Patrick Moynihan is wrong, or does this president just not engender loyalty?
No, it's the, we live at a time when I think it's important to have a debate about these kinds of issues. This is a serious time in our history in 2014. It's a serious time with regards to what direction is this country going to take. We've got a Washington that's largely dysfunctional and stalemate. We're not dealing with the principal issues facing this country. We're dealing with a series of threats abroad. It isn't just ISIS. We're dealing with North Korea. We're dealing with Iran. We're dealing with Russia. We're dealing with cyber attacks. It is an unprecedented set of threats that are out there. This is not a time to kind of get in the trenches and not say anything. This is a time to open up that debate about what is it we need to do, what can we learn from the past, and how do we get together to provide the leadership that's necessary to keep this country strong. I think that's the right debate, and I think people ought to embrace that debate because that's what makes our country what it is.
So we are 4 weeks away from the midterm election, and right now Republicans from Mitt Romney to Senate Republican running in tight contests around the country are saying that they're citing you as proof that President Obama is weak. Do they have a point?
Look, President Obama has been a strong leader. He made a very tough decision with regards to the bin Laden raid, and it was a risky decision, but he made the right decision. He's made the right decision in terms of helping the economy. He's made the right decision in terms of health care. He's been a president who really is trying to provide the right leadership for the country. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk or disagree about certain elements of the leadership. That's part of what goes on. But this president has the ability to establish a strong legacy for the country. We can do immigration reform. We can do a budget deal. We can improve healthcare delivery. We can be energy independent. Democrats, this president, can present a strong agenda to the country. That's what they ought to all run on, the ability to govern this country. And I think Republicans have a hard time, frankly, coming at that issue of governing this country because they, in the House in particular, are largely responsible for undermining government and its efforts to try to help people. That should be the principal issue in this next campaign.
Leon Panetta, the book is Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. We thank you.
Thanks very much.
Much of our reporting on climate change has focused on the impact it could have on people or on the environment in which they live. But one area that tends to get less attention is how climate change will affect wildlife. There's a major habitat restoration project in San Francisco Bay that's trying to address that very issue. The NewsHour's Kat Wise has our report.
So welcome, everyone, to our first morning of trapping.
On a recent morning, a small group of volunteers clad in rubber boots gathered in a park on the edge of San Francisco Bay.
So when the animal walks in, he sets the trap off.
They'd come to help U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials gather traps in a restored tidal marsh to determine if an endangered species found only in this area of the bay is making a comeback. Wildlife biologist Rachel Tertis carefully opened the first trap and out spilled a tiny creature, just what they were hoping to find.
This cinnamon belly would tell us pretty much right away that this is a salt marsh harvest mouse.
The endangered harvest salt marsh mouse is, well, pretty cute. It's lost about 90% of its habitat due to human development along the bay. And now, according to Tertis, it faces a new threat, climate change.
The mouse is really tied to this habitat of pickleweed. They live on this plant. They move up and down the plant throughout the tide cycles. One of the concerns with the climate change is really going to be the sea level rise portion of it. So as the tide increases, you have more water covering more plants. And so they have less areas for those for the mice to move up.
While the odds are stacked against it, the harvest salt marsh mouse and several other endangered and threatened species in San Francisco Bay may have a fighting chance, thanks to a large-scale ecological project now underway. It's called the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, and it's the largest tidal wetland restoration effort on the West Coast.
We're at over 15,000 acres, which is an area about the size of Manhattan.
John Bourgeois is the project's executive manager. He's heading up a multi-agency collaboration to turn former industrial salt ponds back into thriving marshland habitat for wildlife and fish. The ponds, which have lined San Francisco Bay's southern shores for more than 100 years, used to be owned by the Cargill Corporation. In 2003, the state, the federal government, and several private foundations acquired them for $100 million and turned them back into public lands. Since then, 3,500 acres, about 25% of the overall project, have been restored.
We're going to show you how much the habitat's come in.
To see the results firsthand, we hopped on a boat with Bourgeois and traveled several miles to one of the first salt ponds that was opened back up to bay waters.
We're entering into what used to be an industrial salt pond. We actually had to cut through this narrow strip of marsh and through this giant levee here. And what used to be in here was a vast salt flat, just white, barren, looked like a moonscape, hard-packed, dense salt. And 8 years later, with these natural processes coming in and allowed to take over, we've got several feet of mud that's actually accumulated, and with this, a new marsh.
The restored marshes have quickly been repopulated with wildlife. Native bird populations have doubled, and fish are thriving. Leopard sharks and other predators have returned, a sign scientists say of a healthy ecosystem. While it may seem like a typical wetlands restoration, open up the levees and let Mother Nature do her thing, this project is actually charting new ground in restoration science. And officials here say with climate change looming in the future, they are taking a very hands-on approach.
As these marshes are accreting sediment and keeping pace with sea level rise, we're also trying to put other enhancements into the landscape.
John Krause of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife showed us one of those new features specially built into the restored areas to help the harvest salt marsh mouse and other wildlife adapt to rising sea levels.
So there's a mound out in the marsh, and what that has is higher ground that's still within the marsh plain and away from the developed edge where there are predators or people, and providing a place for them to seek refuge and have a place to hide when there are high tide events.
In addition, the sides of existing levees are being widened and planted with native grasses. Krause says scientists are closely monitoring how wildlife and fish react to these changes.
Adaptive management is a term of art and science where you're incorporating change in the landscape and watching those changes over time to learn how you might apply that into the future.
Some species of birds actually flourished in the former salt ponds, so project managers have decided some areas will remain as ponds, but with less salinity and newly added nesting grounds. Project manager John Bourgeois.
This pond in particular has been called a Disneyland for birds. We're really trying to maximize the amount of habitat that's available to them in a novel way.
While the focus of the restoration has been to help wildlife, people will also benefit from new recreation opportunities and, most importantly, from increased flood protection. 7 million people live near the edge of San Francisco Bay, which is expected to rise between 16 and 55 inches over the next century. And many Silicon Valley companies, including Facebook and Google, are a stone's throw from the water's edge. Scientists say the restoration of these marshlands, which can dampen storm surges and prevent tidal erosion, may be the best hope some communities have at mitigating the impacts of sea level rise.
We consider ourselves the St. Bernard Parish of New Orleans in the Bay Area.
Charles Taylor is a high-tech worker who lives in a small community called Alviso at the southern end of the bay. The town has sunk about 13 feet over the years due to groundwater depletion. Flooding is a common occurrence. And now Taylor says residents are worried about what might lie ahead with climate change.
Tidal marshlands, of course, are the best prevention for flooding. So we're definitely hanging our hats on this project.
But while the community is embracing the restoration of the salt ponds, Taylor says some residents feel the effort has been too focused on wildlife. They want project leaders to help them open up 7 acres of slough near the town, which have grown over in recent years.
We'd like to see the Port of Alviso restored. They're concentrating on the wildlife. They're saying it's a wildlife habitat, but it was human habitat prior to that. So at what point do you decide, you know, how far back do you restore?
The project's $1 billion price tag has also been criticized, and some House of Representative Republicans took issue with federal funding to protect the harvest salt marsh mouse during a 2009 stimulus debate.
We'll be paying taxes and interest and debt on this $30 million mouse.
In recent years, the project's been hampered by budget cuts, but Bourgeois says he's doing the best he can for everyone.
The folks that are very wildlife-oriented are concerned that we're providing too much public access. The people that are really concerned about flooding are concerned that we're spending too much time on habitat, and vice versa. So it's all a balancing act, and I figure in my role is if everyone's just a little bit upset with me, I'm probably walking the right line.
The project is expected to take another 30 years to complete. The planning is now underway for a new levee breach, which will bring back bay waters to several hundred acres for the first time in more than a century.
Online, we have an even better view of exactly how much is left of the tidal wetlands in San Francisco Bay. You can find that video at pbs.org/newshour.
In this midterm election, the fight for control of the Senate dominates the headlines. But as Jacob Kaufman of KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock, Arkansas reports, there are issues like raising the minimum wage, which might be key to driving voters to the polls.
We're letting you know so you can go out and vote for this.
Going door to door in the Oak Forest neighborhood of Little Rock, Gloria Smith is urging people to get out to vote for a minimum wage increase.
And I'm just coming out telling you to go out and vote for the minimum wage, $8.50 an hour. Yeah,
right now in Arkansas.
Currently, the Arkansas minimum wage is $6.25 an hour, a dollar less than the federal minimum wage. Georgia and Wyoming are the only other states to have rates below the federal level. The proposal on the Arkansas ballot would raise the rate in stages to $8.50 an hour by January 2017.
And I know you're a registered voter.
Smith says such an increase is long overdue.
It would help a lot of families, especially mothers that have children in daycare. A lot of people have to go to churches to get food to make out because they can't afford to buy the food. So I like to see business pay people what they're worth.
I'm going to get to go to school today.
36-year-old Gregory Stewart would certainly like to see employers pay a higher wage. He holds down two jobs throughout the year at a restaurant and a ballpark. And still, to make ends meet, he and his two daughters had to move in with his mother and grandmother.
She's a big girl.
He says raising his wages would make a huge difference for his family.
Certainly being able to provide a good home life where they can have at least three very good meals a day.
Oh, okay.
But Roger Lacey, who owns a janitorial service company, says he believes raising the minimum wage would actually hurt the people it intends to help. Lacey employs more than 200 workers. Most are part-time and nearly all earn the minimum wage.
My big opposition to the minimum wage is what it does to the teenage community. Currently, about 24% of minimum wage workers are teenagers. And when you price the per hour rate to where it's people don't want to hire them, then they won't get on the ladder to getting a job.
Arkansas is one of five states where voters will decide this fall whether to raise their state's minimum wage. Ironically, four of the five states are Republican strongholds. Democrats are hoping that these measures will help spur liberal-leaning voters to turn out in greater numbers, which could help Democratic candidates up and down the ballot.
There's a large number of voters that vote in presidential elections but drop off or don't vote in off-year elections. So issues like the minimum wage and ballot initiatives are meant to kind of reach those voters to get them to go to the polls.
It's really Gregory Shufelt is a political science professor at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. He says it's no accident that in most of the states where minimum wage is on the ballot, there's also a competitive Senate race. In Arkansas, the race is between two-term incumbent Mark Pryor, the Democrat, and Republican U.S. Representative Tom Cotton. Pryor is the first statewide elected official in Arkansas to support the increase. Cotton, until recently, said he opposed minimum wage increases. But just 2 days after the measure was officially put on the ballot, he said he would vote for the November initiative. With polls showing overwhelming support for the measure, Republicans have virtually no choice but to indicate approval, says Shufelt.
They might have philosophical reasons or economic reasons why they think it might be a bad idea, but politically, it's a non-starter for them.
My dad started this mill in 1947.
That is certainly the case with State Representative David Branscombe.
People don't realize the expenses.
He owns a cattle ranch and a sawmill in northern Arkansas. He pays above the minimum wage, but says as a businessman, he's opposed to having the government dictate the wages he pays employees.
The reality is, in a small business environment that I'm in, I can only pay so much. I mean, I am dictated by the national markets, from the lumber market to tie market. They all tell me what I'm going to get. I have no control over that. But if the government's going to come in and say, well, you're going to have to do this, then maybe I can't. Maybe I shut down.
But as a representative, Branscombe says he's going to have to support the ballot initiative.
Well, that's because, 80% of the people are for it. I mean, it's hard to come out and be, strongly opposed to a position when everybody wants to try to help everybody out. I mean, that's why we're here, to try to help people. But as a Republican, you don't want to hurt business. So it's a delicate balancing act that we have to do.
How are you?
Patrick Hayes is the former mayor of North Little Rock, a Democrat. He's running for a U.S. House seat in Arkansas's most Democratic-leaning district.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
He recently greeted people at the Taste of the Town, an annual festival featuring local restaurants. He says he's hopeful that with Republicans saying they support minimum wage measures, there may even be enough bipartisan cooperation to get a federal increase passed.
There needs to be an increase, and whether it be 10-10 or whether it be something less, I'd hope that we could arrive at that on a bipartisan basis and then go forward, because I think the country, country will benefit by that.
How you doing?
Prospects of a federal increase are unlikely. Many Democrats, including Senator Pryor, opposed to a higher rate. But passage of the five different state measures is quite likely, especially if history is any guide. Since 2002, 10 states have voted on minimum wage increases, and all 10 measures were approved with overwhelming support.
Finally tonight, deciding what's important and preparing for the inevitable, a conversation about the end of life. Jeffrey Brown has that.
I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. Words written by a surgeon, but if you take out the reference to medical school, probably true of most of us. We might learn to live, few of us learn to die. That is the subject of a new book titled Being Mortal, and the aforementioned surgeon is also the author, Atul Gawande, and welcome to you.
Thank you.
There are two facts of life you seem to focus on. One is that, yes, we all age and die, and the other is that we don't seem to understand it very well.
No. Medicine has taken over mortality in some sense. We are responsible more and more for trying to fix the problems of aging and dying, but we don't know how to do it. And I think the thing that I discovered was we have a fundamental failure. We don't recognize that people have priorities besides just living longer.
Why do we not understand that? I mean, that we want to live longer, but we want to live longer in a certain way with certain values and beliefs.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Some people will say, it's really important to me that my brain work, that I am who I am. Mm-hmm. Other people will say, look, I just want to know that I'm not suffering and that I'm not in pain. Mm-hmm. Others will say, I have a life project that's really important to me. And the fact that we in medicine, we prioritize health, safety, and survival. We think that must be what people place mm-hmm. first. But in fact, we make choices all the time in our own homes about risks we take. And one of the consequences is that in medicine, as we face problems we can't fix, like aging or a terminal illness, we often sacrifice the very reasons that people want to be alive.
You're writing about your profession, you're writing about some large societal issues, but you write about it in very personal terms, in your own family, right?
I interviewed more than 200 patients and family members mm-hmm. about their experiences with aging and serious illness. I tracked geriatricians, palliative care specialists, nursing home workers, and my dad along the way got a diagnosis of a brain tumor mm-hmm. in his brainstem and his spinal cord. And I realized the stakes of this was, how could we make it so that he is not, that he gets every chance he has, but then that we're also not making him suffer right through the end and taking away things that are really important to him? What I found is that it's pretty simple. Priorities really matter for patients. The most reliable way to know people's priorities is to ask about them.
Just ask.
And we don't. We don't in medicine.
Well, why is that? I mean, it seems so. I read it and you say it and it sounds obvious. Just ask, what is it that you want when you're at the end of your life? But doctors don't, even family members don't.
Well, first of all, it's the words, right? That's a really painful set of words to say to somebody.
Yeah.
What do you want at the end of your life? You're saying I'm might as well give up now?
Mm-hmm.
What I found was tracking people who are really good at these conversations, they ask the questions in very different ways. They ask, well, what's your understanding of your condition? And people will also often say, well, I know I can't be cured or that I might even die. Then you say, what are your fears and worries for the future? What are the goals you have if your health should worsen? And what are the trade-offs you're willing to make and not willing to make? And asked that way, what you're saying to people is, I want to know your priorities, besides just being a, you know, pulsing body alive, but not getting to have life, not really living.
And all of this, of course, in a society that is, we're living longer. Technology allows that. So these kinds of issues come up ever more. I don't think there's probably not a person listening to this that hasn't faced it in some way.
That's right. Either because we ourselves face it or we have a parent mm-hmm. that is facing it. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is all of that success, our ability to have technology that can always do something more. We can put you on the ventilator. We can give you another round of chemotherapy. That we haven't learned, well, what does it mean to even die? And then going further upstream, what does it mean to make choices where some of these things take away quality of life that we care about even before you die? And I think the answer is that we haven't had the words around articulating what our priorities really are. For example, doctors, our approach used to be 50 years ago, it was doctor knows best. Mm-hmm. Paternalism, we're going to tell you exactly what you're going to get, and we're not going to actually tell you what's going on with you. Right. And we rebelled against that in the 80s and 90s. We moved to doctor informative, almost a retail mode. Here are the options A, B, C, D. Here are the risks, the benefits, the pros, the cons. What do you want? And people would say, well, what do you recommend, doctor? And I was actually taught to say, well, it's not my decision. This is yours. Mm-hmm. What people want is a counselor. An effective counselor is someone who can talk to you about, you know, what do these numbers mean? What are you actually worried about for me, doctor? And then let me tell you my priorities and help me choose which option will meet them.
Do you see that changing in your profession? Do you see a better understanding of the empathy that's required to ask the kinds of questions you're proposing?
I think we actually are full of people in our profession who have had that empathy. If I can judge from my own situation, I wanted to do better. I tell the story of a 34-year-old woman diagnosed in her eighth month of pregnancy with terminal lung cancer, and we actually spoke about the idea that we did not want to be on the train all the way to the end to the point that she never had time and quality of life because she knew it was going to be incurable, but she wanted the best possible treatments. And yet we took that train right off the cliff practically. We never got off with making sure that quality of life got there. And I think the reason why is we have anxiety about asking these questions, patients, doctors, family members, because we haven't had the words. And I think we know now increasingly more about what people who are really good at these conversations do. And it's important to understand they are a skill. They require asking a few of these questions, and you have to ask them repeatedly over time because people's priorities change as time goes on.
All right. You know what? We'll continue our discussion online, and for now, the book is Being Mortal, Atul Gawande. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, the major developments of the day, West African leaders appeal to the outside world to help stop the Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 4,000 people. Wall Street had another wild day as energy stocks plunged and triggered a sell-off. The Dow Industrials fell 335 points. And comedian and TV actress Jan Hooks has died. She was a regular on Saturday Night Live in the late 80s and also had roles on Designing Women and Third Rock from the Sun. Jan Hooks was 57.
On the NewsHour online right now, you may know London's subway as the Underground or the Tube. There's also a whole world below the city's streets. A group of urban explorers went in search of the subterranean city, breaking into the sewers and discovering abandoned bunkers and shuttered train stations. You can see a photo gallery of what they found on our Artbeat page. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour.
And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Friday, we'll look at a new movie that tells the harrowing story of the lost boys of Sudan and the actor who lived the struggle he now captures on screen. I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening with Mark Shields and Michael Gerson. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by... Our economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. And by BAE Systems, inspired work. The Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.